From the heart of San Francisco and going out to all America, this is Green 960 AM, the Radio EcoShock Show. As night fell over Los Angeles, I pulled off the freeway to the nearest diner. Like all the freeway restaurants, there was nothing special about this one. It was dim inside as my eyes adjusted to a horrible scene. Settling into my oversized captain's chair, I was the freak. Without a lie, all the other diners, all of them, were over 250 pounds. The arriving plate was wider than my shoulders and laden with three meals in one. I felt so small. Later in the parking lot, I understood, perhaps for the first time, the rise of Detroit's personal pickup trucks and SUVs. These folks were never going to fit into a Toyota Prius. That's when I realized a connection between diet, the worldwide plunge into fat, and climate change. For one thing, University of Illinois professor Sheldon H. Jacobson calculates it takes a billion more gallons of gas every year just to carry all the extra weight of overweight Americans. That's just the beginning. On May 8th, an article in the British medical journal, The Lancet, calculated overweight and obese people increase greenhouse gases by up to 18%. What with their reliance on motor transport versus walking, and the agricultural gases from producing and shipping all that extra food? It's certainly just not an American tragedy. They call it globesity. A writer for the World Health Organization coined the term in 2001 for a rising epidemic of obesity around the globe. In Denmark, South Africa, China, India, and the Philippines, people are bloated. There are now more overweight people, over a billion, than underfed or starving humans.
I don't know how you came by this record, but you are now embarked upon a journey that must certainly lead you to change your life forever.
We go to France now to talk with the author of a new book from the publisher EarthScan. Michelle Holdsworth is Associate Professor of Public Health Nutrition at the University of Nottingham, UK. She is one of four authors behind the new EarthScan book, Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. Michelle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, there's lots to talk about. Some of it's sensitive to people with weight problems, but we must start with the definition of globesity. What is it?
Okay, the term globesity was introduced by the World Health Organization in 2001. It's really a blend of the term global and obesity. And the idea was really to try and expel the myth that obesity was just a problem in westernized countries, and that we now have a worldwide epidemic of obesity.
I noticed chapter one of the book is titled Wave of Panic Across the Planet. Is that over the top, or why should we panic?
Obviously, now we're seeing that the incidence of obesity is touching one out of 12 people throughout the whole planet, and overweight, one in six people. So it's really an escalating epidemic, which has increased over the last 10 years, really, at an enormous rate. In the United States, it's obviously increased earlier, but now we're seeing that lots of other countries are catching up with the prevalences that we see in the United States and in North America generally. And we're seeing that these problems are now in even poorer countries of the world.
But it is very advanced in countries like the UK. I've seen unbelievable figures of the number of people who are overweight or obese there.
Yes, in the UK what we're seeing is about one in four people are obese, which is pretty much the same as in Canada as well, where we also have figures of one in four obese for men and women. These are still less than in the United States, which has one in three estimates of people obese. But in terms of overweight, we have roughly two-thirds of the population in England, but also in Canada, who are overweight.
And I guess that's a public health emergency. I mean, a lot of people are going to die much younger because of their weight problems.
Obviously, this is a huge concern that countries, even wealthy countries, can't afford actually to care for the consequences of obesity. Obviously, the particular health concerns are diabetes, which we're even seeing now in children who are overweight and obese. And these are obviously have very high costs in terms of drug treatment. And we're seeing that particularly in the developing countries where I work as well. These countries really are not geared up, are not financially able to support the rise of chronic diseases like obesity is causing, such as cancer, heart disease and diabetes.
Could you give us a quick example of what you've seen in a developing country on this?
Okay, I mean, I've particularly been working on projects in North Africa, in Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria. And here we're seeing rates of obesity that are not that far off those in the United States for women. And really what we're seeing is that the governments are looking to see how they can adapt the health system to deal with the double burden that they experience of infectious diseases, which are still rampant, and also these chronic diseases. So it's really a huge challenge for them.
And that's come up in the last 20 to 30 years, because I traveled through all three of those countries in the late 1970s, and people were pretty slim, I have to say.
Yes, I mean, some of those countries do have studies from before which have shown a rapid increase. What's particularly happened is that in a lot of African countries, but also some Asian countries, a lot of people are moving into cities and to therefore not doing so much physical activity because of city life being much more sedentary, moving less, eating more high-calorie foods which are accessible, which they could previously not eat at all. So the diets are changing, they're doing less physical activity, and this is happening very quickly, which is having a very quick impact on obesity and overweight in adults particularly.
And I think people feel that part of the move up the ladder economically is to start eating meat as well, or more meat.
Yes, obviously that's a definite trend we're seeing, particularly in emerging countries such as China and in Asia, this huge increase in meat consumption, which is obviously of concern because we also see in a lot of countries there's a very strong correlation between meat consumption and obesity. But also, obviously, in terms of the planet and in terms of the carbon impact of that, that's also a negative effect.
You also have the idea in the book that there are parallels between the difficulties in recognizing and dealing with both these problems. What similarities did you see between globesity and global warming as issues?
Well, I think obviously both of them are very complex situations. They both have very complex causes, and also they're both been around for a while, and in terms of public consciousness, people very quickly accept both of them as kind of inevitable situations. But also when we looked more into what the causes of both of these were, they were very related, the actual causes of climate change and obesity are interrelated on quite a lot of different levels.
Well, I suppose one level would be globalization and another industrialization of the food system. This is part of my frustration, Michelle. It's everybody's willing to talk about a healthy diet and exercise for individuals, but it seems like there are corporations who are pushing fattening foods and huge cars and video games where you sit about, but governments don't want to talk about that.
Well, maybe your government doesn't. I think, as you mentioned, the whole food system was originally set up as it is now to produce enough food to feed hungry people. And it was really the goal then of the Food and Agricultural Association to feed hunger and to make sure that nobody was starving. And obviously this has now continued and we're actually overfeeding the population. And within that, I mean, obviously the food industry doesn't set out to make people obese, but unfortunately the problem is that the products they sell, which are high calorie, high in fat and high in sugar, are there where there's the most profit to be made. We're particularly looking in Europe as well at how some of their activities could be curbed or controlled. And actually the WHO, the World Health Organization, is looking at trying to work together with industry. Whether this is going to work is another question, but there are moves towards that.
I'd like to see some more responsible advertising, too, because right now I don't have to go very far to find a big billboard here showing a double cheeseburger with double meat patties and two layers of bacon on top of that. So this is going to result in heart disease and diabetes, as you say. Possibly, if we take it on a big scale, millions of deaths. This is a huge chain selling this product. And yet, people aren't reacting to it. People don't seem, I don't see any protests about it.
Well, I think some people are protesting. I mean, the International Obesity Task Force, amongst others, has trying to lobby governments to develop a global code for controlling advertising. Now, this is advertising particularly to children in the first instance, to see how, you know, whether we can introduce measures which reduce the exposure of children to advertising, because children are seen as the least able to discriminate between advertising and the most easily influenced. So they're lobbying to really try and get governments to take this on board, to introduce controls. Within the European Union, we're looking at introducing controls on advertising to children during the evening television, for example. There's a big debate on whether that should be up to the age of 18 and what time of day that should be. So there are initiatives, but these need to be, governments need to support them and to try and resist the lobbying from industry that they obviously get.
Well, that's good to hear. Our guest is Michelle Holdsworth, part of a team of authors of a new book, Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. Now, Michelle, I want to get into the climate change a little bit more, but first I want to just check this one thing. I've looked at some blog reactions to the concept of Globesity, and some overweight people, they're outraged. They'll now be blamed for global warming as well. How do you handle that kind of sensitivity in the book?
Well, Globesity doesn't actually blame. It isn't actually a term which is connecting the global climate change with obesity. And I think for myself, I would rather focus on the fact that the causes of obesity and the causes of climate change are actually joint, if you like, or shared. And it's not the fact that when someone has become obese, it's obviously there's been a lot of press recently about the fact that being obese has a larger carbon footprint. But for me, we need to go one step back and look at what causes obesity. And for us, that's really looking more at the food system. I mean, our basic belief is that people who are obese, they're more really, if you like, it's absurd to blame the overeaters themselves. They're really just a product of a very unhealthy food system, which is pushing cheap food at them and making unhealthy food inaccessible.
I really agree with you on that, you know, but two researchers, Phil Edwards and Ian Roberts, published a letter in the UK medical journal The Lancet on May 8th. They said the trend towards obesity adds directly to climate change, citing greenhouse gases from all that extra food production, the need for bigger vehicles instead of walking and so on. You know, wouldn't you have to agree there is a direct connection too?
Yes. No, I do agree that there is a consequence of being obese on the carbon footprint. As you just said, you just quoted a study which has been covered quite a lot in the press in Europe as well. But I don't think we should blame the obese, because what I'm saying is that the reason that so many are becoming overweight and obese is precisely for all these reasons which are related to factors outside of their control, to the environment that they're living, which we're all responsible for, which push extra portions of food onto people, which make eating healthily very difficult, but also make doing physical activity very difficult as well. So we would argue that it's actually the obesogenic environment that we live in which is contributing mostly to obesity. And if we could do something about that, then yes, we would be able to deal then with this consequence of being obese and its impact on the carbon footprint.
It is a really difficult problem. I know, for example, in Latin America, some places people don't have access to vegetables, even though it's a great place to grow them, because of the way land ownership is laid out. They just can't get access to the land to grow it. So it seems like there are large social changes that would have to happen to combat Globesity.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it really, some European academics have suggested very radical changes are needed to combat obesity worldwide, because as we can see, it's escalating throughout the world, and that something really very fundamental needs to happen to change it. We can't expect people to change their individual behavior unless we can change the environment in which they're living. Individuals are programmed really to prefer sweet and fatty foods, which was in times of famine an advantage for them. That's why we all enjoy these kind of foods. That's why our bodies crave them. And so we're asking people to go against a lot of their sensorial instincts, but also we need to give them an environment which helps them control their weight, whereas the environment, as you just mentioned yourself, you go out into the street and you see lots of incentives to eat unhealthily, they're all conspiring against that. So really, we think we need fundamental changes. Some people have suggested in the UK to introduce rationing of food is what's needed to help both with the climate consequences of overeating and obesity.
Yeah, so you would have a ration ticket for so many calories and that's it. Well, that is going to be hard to talk people into that one, but we'll see.
Yes.
How bad things get before we look for big solutions. Well, your book concludes by calling obesity and climate change an odd couple. How do you see these two issues interacting in the next decade or so?
I think if people's awareness about carbon emissions can have an influence on their actual weight behavior, that could be one way. But I still think we need to make very fundamental changes to the environment that people live in and the way that we live. For example, the use of cars has been shown to have a huge impact, obviously on carbon emissions, but also on people's weight gain. That using your car every year for an hour every day, you're likely to actually gain about 14 kilograms over a two-year period. So just a small thing like using your car can actually promote your weight gain as well.
Is there anything you'd like to add, a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think one of the things I'd really like people to understand is to really understand that it's a myth that obese people become obese because they're greedy and lazy. So much research has shown that people become overweight and obese over a very long period of time and with very small differences in their energy balance. So they're just maybe eating a little bit more than they need or walking a bit less than they need every day, and suddenly in 5 years they find they've become overweight or obese. So I really think it's important that people understand that that stigma associated with overweight and obesity is untrue, and we need to understand the real causes to find the real solutions.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with Michelle Holdsworth, co-author of a new book from EarthScan called Globesity, A Planet Out of Control. Michelle, thank you again for sharing your time.
Okay, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM San Francisco.
And now for something completely different.
Hi, this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Our next topic seems like a steep change, but it isn't. I'll outline how I canned 9 bottles of rhubarb last weekend. You'll learn how to get started. Ensuring food for the family helps me cope with frightening financial news, and I'm switching to a lower carbon food supply. It's cheaper, too. That's all part of my bigger claim. We need to put away food at harvest time. No one living in all the centuries past could believe we even need to say this. Of course we harvest nature's bounty when it comes. But big city folk forget this basic survival trait within one or two generations. We depend on massive food webs from oil-based industrial agriculture transported by fossil fuels. Rhubarb is an easy way to start. These tart red stalks are among the first spring crops. Don't make the mistake I did in choosing a cheap enamel canner. These are the dark, sometimes spotted enamel canning kettles that come with a lid and wire bottle rack, usually for less than $40. They are very good for canning acidic fruit. First of all, this canner could not sit flat on a burner on my small electric stove. It was so wide, it either hit one of the stove rims, lifting it off the burner, or tipped slightly, even on the biggest element. That means uneven heat or even a dangerous situation. Worse, this alleged 5-quart canning kettle was not deep enough to allow a 1-liter or a 1-quart bottle to boil vigorously. The kettle is only 10 inches deep, and you need at least 12 inches deep, preferably 14, to prevent boiling water from splashing all over the stove. Measure the canner depth before you buy. My project was to get fresh-cut rhubarb, preferably organic, and can it the very same day to preserve all the vitamins and taste. That turns out to be an all-day, maybe even into the evening deal. I bought organic rhubarb at $2 a pound Canadian at two different stalls, cleaning one of them right out. That's half the price for non-organic rhubarb at Safeway, where it was $3.99 a pound. Already, I'm set to cut my food costs in half. Plus, my food was grown locally from a family operation with much lower carbon costs for transportation. This is a food that will not crowd out your freezer and doesn't depend on electricity to keep well. Wash the rhubarb, cut it into 1-inch pieces. I bought $43 worth, a substantial investment for me. That was 21 pounds of raw rhubarb. It produced 9.5 liters or maybe 9 quarts of preserves ready for the winter. When doing a large batch, you have to plan your stove use carefully. First of all, you need clean hot bottles and lids. Once the rhubarb is chopped up, don't cook it yet. You add sugar, a little less than 1/2 cup to 4 cups of rhubarb. That means you toss your cut rhubarb into a measuring cup as you go, and then pour that into your big cooking pot. Keep track, so you know how much sugar to add. Mix the sugar and fruit together and let stand for 4 hours. Lots of water will come out of the fruit, making a syrup to accompany your bottling process. The secret now is to have everything hot as it goes in to the hot but not boiling water in your canner. These bottles should be hot in a pot of water. I heat up my lids and rings in a separate little pot, and my rhubarb is hot, in this case in 2 big pots, since it wouldn't fit in my undersized enamel canner and still leave room to stir in that sugar. So I put another batch of rhubarb in a big kitchen pot. That makes 4 pots on a 4-burner stove with no room to spare. The hot fruit goes into hot jars using a canning funnel with a quick wipe of the rim by a clean cloth or paper towel. In my case, I used a cheap enamel kettle to heat the fruit, bringing the sugary mixture to a boil for just 1 minute only, then turn down the heat. It will actually cook in the jars during the canning process. Load up your jars and bring to a boil for 15 minutes near sea level, or maybe 18 minutes for the high altitude folks. It takes all night for the bottles to cool, and this is when the seal is really made. Put your hot bottles where they can sit undisturbed and totally untouched, even by you, for 12 hours. Then check that the lids have pulled down concave, which indicates a tight seal. The bottles need to be stored in the dark. That was my trial run before I go to the farms to buy a few bushels of fresh fruit and vegetables this summer. In fact, I look at this whole year as a trial run for learning basic survival tactics. It looks like our so-called normal economy will continue, for the employed at least, for another year, maybe. After that, the wheels may come off. Then smart adapters will be using homesteading tools like canning wherever we live, just to ensure food for the coming year. But even if a miracle saves the banks and the shipping and the shopping malls, you and I can still get fresher, better food at half the cost or less by buying in bulk as each crop arrives. Happy Food Storage helps me relax in scary times. I hope it helps you too. I'm Alex, and this is Radio EcoShock. Download this free MP3 anytime from our survival page at ecoshock.org.